This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, anti-war activists from around the country gathered in Baltimore to agitate for an end to U.S. military bases around the world. Supporters of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal will converge on Philadelphia, seeking a reversal of his 36-year-old murder conviction, and a celebration of 300 years of Black history in New Orleans.
But first, Dr. Martin Luther King's life and work has been institutionalized with commemorations of his birthday occurring this week in virtually every city and town in the nation. Dr. King's anti-war views are less celebrated by the powers that be. King called for a movement to oppose the triple evils of racism, militarism, and materialism, and indicted the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. We spoke with Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montara in Philadelphia.
On this Martin Luther King Day, I think it's apparent that Martin Luther King, the man that he was and the figure in history that he was, remains relevant precisely for the reason that you have put on the table. He stood up against imperialism and war and economic exploitation, be it in the United States or around the world. So King remains relevant. His message remains relevant. His life remains relevant. However, to bring his relevance forward requires a very tough ideological struggle against the neoliberal elite, including those in the Black misleadership class and the intelligentsia who dance to the tune of the neoliberals, be they in the Republican or Democratic Party. So looking forward, it was King who reminded us of the fierce urgency of now. Imperialism is in a crisis. Europe as a civilizational project, and I'm not just talking about continental Europe, I'm talking about the European world, or what we could call the white world, is in crisis. It is a civilizational crisis, which means that it is much deeper than its economic manifestations. What we're looking at is pretty much the collapse and unraveling of Europe and the irresistible rise of Asia and its necessary consort, Africa.
Well, how is this working out in actual terms in the world? The rise of Asia, usually folks are speaking about China when they speak that way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a complicated process. Certainly, the present anchor of this rise is China. However, Chinese diplomats and politicians and their leadership realize that its rise cannot be sustained unless China is allied with other Asian countries and with Africa. For example, the strategic alliance between China and Russia, the moves towards détente between China and Vietnam, the movement of the Philippines closer to China. Hopefully in the future, we will see a détente between India and China. Certainly, the new movements and developments between Pakistan and China, where trade between the two nations will take place in Yuan. A big part of this rise of Asia, and then I see the same logic occurring between Africa and Asia is decoupling from the dollar. The dollar, which since 1971 has been the reserve currency, is not so strong these days. I would suggest that this movement towards cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and so on is an attempt to forestall the rise of other currencies such as the Chinese yuan, the Russian ruble, and so on.
Well, certainly the growing ties between Russia and China are dramatic, but Africa in resistance to U.S. Euro imperialism, that picture is much more murky. Where do you see Africa rising?
Well, and you're right, it is murky and it is difficult. The great problem that Africa faces is how will it achieve unity? And I mean substantive unity, not just unity in talk or formal unity. And to get there, they're going to have to find a way to overcome the partition of Africa, which in the 21st century has produced all of these pretty much mini states, 54 nations, and who knows how many more will come as imperialism gets involved in the affairs of nations and destabilizes them. You know, imperialism would like to see 100 African nations bickering and fighting and each nation's leadership prancing around at the UN as though they had some power. That's what imperialism wants. Now, to overcome that, I think, requires ultimately a number of states. I mean, a few states, no more than 10. You could call them federated states. For example, a West African Federation, a Central African Federation, a Northeast Africa and Horn of Africa Federation. And ultimately, these federated states would operate like single states. And finally, a African Union that is united in actuality, that is a single currency backed up by gold, a single foreign policy, a single military policy. And of course, this means a relinquishing of the little bit of power that each of these nations have for the good of the whole continent, which would mean creating a very, very powerful economy, a very, very powerful political entity in the world, which could then be a legitimate and reliable negotiating partner with the 1.5 billion people in China or the 1.3 or 4 billion people in India. Hence, the 1.5 billion Africans would bring their weight just in numbers, not to mention the economic potential, to the table of global affairs and ultimately the remaking of the world away from European civilization towards a human civilization anchored in the unity of Africa and Asia.
Well, that's a very hopeful prospect, and in particulars, it sounds very much like that which was pursued by the deposed and murdered former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. But the United States, through its AFRICOM, virtually militarily occupies Africa. And of those 54 independent nations on the continent, at least 53 are in some kind of agreement with the AFRICOM military organization. How does that scenario that you spoke of come to pass under the present kind of relationship?
We have to look at the United States in particular, the largest empire in human history, the most lethal military in human history. We must look at the United States as an empire in decline, which is part and parcel of the decline in what I'm calling the collapse of Europe. Certainly, Africa is very weak relative to the United States and the NATO powers, militarily and economically. However, the United States leadership is not united. There is a big fight over whether or not the United States can afford the cost of empire. all of these interventions and regime changes and threats of nuclear war against North Korea, threats of war and nuclear war against Russia. Well, you know, they're selling a lot of wolf tickets, and I don't think they could back it up, because the internal contradictions at the level of the ruling elite are such that I don't believe they can strategically unite around anything. Now, on the other side, as imperfect as it is, we are witnessing new levels of unity to challenge the American empire and the American hegemonist.
You raise the question of whether the United States can afford the cost of empire, but how would the ruling elite in the United States maintain its position in the world without a military-based coercive empire?
Well, that's my point. It can't. And with all of the threats, there are contradictions in the United States that are deepening every day. Half of the American population is near poverty. One-third of the American population is in officially defined poverty. The younger generation cannot imagine a future for itself under the existing arrangements of class and race. This is a country that is going to be forced to turn inward. And forms of what we could call civil war are not out of the question. An angry white population which sees the decline of the power of whiteness and white privilege, who are dissatisfied with all of those leaders and spokesmen that got them to this point. I don't think these people are ready for war. Certainly not a war with a nation, let us say North Korea, that is technologically the equivalent of the United States, and in terms of its population is more united and prepared for a protracted military struggle if it comes to that. The American people do not have that same spirit of, quote, defending American interests overseas. So I think the war makers and the military are up against some serious problems. Now, I know you're going to ask me, or I'm anticipating that you'll ask me, well, but white people will turn to racism rather than go up against the white elite. I think the white masses are severely and deeply divided. In fact, many will do as you could suggest. But I think there is a critical mass of them who have washed their hands of this, especially among young people of multiple political positions and class and ideological positions. The young are not going for this anymore.
Well, polls have shown that the American public is not in line with the two war parties' belligerence in international affairs. But where is the peace party?
Well, that's the problem. The problem for the masses is leadership. Who will lead? And I'm not talking about a single leader. I'm talking about a united people who are galvanized behind a set of very simple demands, such as universal health care, jobs, education, none of which can be achieved without taking down the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the military. I mean, if the ruling class cannot afford empire, certainly the people of this country can't afford empire. And at some point, questions of class and the well-being of ordinary people kind of trumps the whole whiteness, racist proclivity. That's not to say that these white people are going to give it up overnight, but it throws them into turmoil when their white identity conflicts with their class position, by which I mean the ever-descending process into poverty, unemployment, drug addiction, suicide, all of these social problems that manifest a society and, in fact, a civilization that is unraveling.
Well, you're addressing the political crisis in white America, but there certainly can be no peace party in the United States without the active participation of black America. And the black political establishment seems solidly aligned with the forces of militarism and racism and capitalism.
And that's their dilemma, because they're going to go down with the neoliberals. The Maxine Waters of the world, just to name one, will go down with them, and they know it. I could even mention the Oprah Winfreys of the world. They have no future because they have lost the trust and respect of Afro-America. And, you know, I think the best indicator of it all was Alabama. You know, we don't get the clearest representation of what went on there. We do know that 97% of black women voted against Roy Moore. We know that 94% of black men did. Now that, you know, people take that lightly. That is humongous and has deep historical meaning. Now, of course, it took place within the straitjacket of the two-party system. But black folks saw an opportunity, not just to defeat Roy Moore, but to say in no uncertain terms, we are voting for jobs, we are voting for schools, we are voting for health care, and that's it. I think it was an act in the main of profound political independence and bodes well for the future of black resistance. Now, the revolutionary and radical forces who should, if we are wise and if we are tactically sophisticated, can move to positions of real influence within the masses of our people in a way that we were kind of locked out during the years of Obama. And frankly, when you look at Alabama, it seems to me that the Obama time is over, that black folk, and especially the masses, are looking at their objective conditions of life, are assessing them, are thinking collectively, and acting in ways that no other part of the population does act. I think it's very, very positive going forward.
Near the end of Obama time, 2 years ago in Philadelphia, you were one of the organizers of an historic conference on the Black radical tradition. But how is that tradition faring under this new regime of Trump?
Well, I think it's faring quite well. I mean, Trump is not a single individual. I mean, Trump is a manifestation of something far deeper. And the kind of internal struggle that his election kicked off, basically a struggle to say you were elected, but you're not going to take power. That kind of struggle to prevent him from taking power has begun to show black folk what the nature of power, what the nature of class and race rule are in this country. I think this is all educational stuff for the masses. The black radical tradition provides important ways of looking at a situation like that, like this, because at the core of the black radical tradition is an understanding of the inevitable crisis. In fact, now the terminal crisis of American imperialism, that there will come a time, and they all thought, like be it Du Bois or Baldwin or C.L.R. James or Fannie Lou Hamer, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm, that at some point, the unity of white folk fractures. When white folk are disunited, black people have greater possibilities to unite and advance an agenda which is in the interest of the entire nation. I think that's what is coming forward at this time. I think we radicals have opportunities that we have not had in over 40 years to impact the direction of our people. We see a decline in the legitimacy and influence of the Al Sharptons, of the Congressional Black Caucus, of the Oprah Winfreys, if you will. But at the same time, we see the masses of people listening, attempting to hear what they only a few years ago would have thought was outlandish and unworthy of consideration.
You and like-minded activists in Philadelphia are going to spend much of the coming year celebrating the life and work of W.E.B. Du Bois. And how are his long, long life and deep political researches relevant to today?
Well, you know, this year is the 150th anniversary of his birth, which is an important occasion. And we are going to celebrate it here. Philadelphia is going to celebrate it. The city council is going to pass a resolution declaring this the year of W.E.B. Du Bois. And Philadelphia will read and study and think about Du Bois. Now, what is the significance of this? Let us never forget that the ruling elite of this country for over 40 years, and even up till today, have waged a ideological campaign to erase Du Bois from the thinking and ideology of the Black community and progressive community, and to distort what he stood for and the meaning of his work. We intend to make a dent in that, to restore him as a central figure in the ideological struggle for Black freedom in the United States and for the fight against colonialism and imperialism worldwide. Of course, when we begin to talk about Du Bois, that brings up every question that confronts the people today. For example, what is the nature of white supremacy? What is the nature of capitalism? What is the nature of colonialism? Why must the struggle of Black people be internationalized, as Du Bois always argued? What type of pan-Africa do we need at this moment? What is the nature of the cultural and artistic and literary revolution that Black America needs to galvanize us around art and how art shapes the character of a people? All of this was a part of the body of work that is W.E.B. Du Bois. And of course, as an example to young people and to Black people, period, moral courage, principled politics. That doesn't mean you're always going to be right or everybody's going to agree upon anything. But putting the principle of resistance ahead of individual rewards, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something colossal, something global, something futuristic, something that thinks in terms of radical transformation of the world itself.
That was Dr. Anthony Matiro speaking from Philadelphia.
Like virtually no other empire in all of human history, the United States virtually covers the world with military bases, with servicemen and women in 172 countries, by some counts. At the University of Baltimore this past weekend, anti-war activists held a conference against U.S. foreign military bases. Among the keynote speakers was Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party's 2016 vice presidential candidate and lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace.
All power to the people. All power to the people. This must be more than just, and it is, more than a slogan. This commitment to bringing power to the people has to be the defining mission of our work. Many of us have been involved in this struggle, this attempt to build power for the masses of the oppressed people in this country and around the world for quite some time. We have been successful in fact, building a degree of power, but we know that we have before us a challenge and a responsibility. And that's why we're here this evening. We understand that the little bit of progress we've been able to make in this country to expand the range of democracy coming out of the so-called civil rights struggle and the black liberation movements and the anti-war movements of the 1960s and 1970s. We know that that progress, those spaces that we opened up, were in many cases quickly reversed. So we know how tenuous progress can be. We know that because we are living the consequence of the counter-revolutionary process that emerged in the 1970s, we are living that reality today with the evolution of the corporate Democrats and neoliberalism and the ascendancy of Donald Trump. We are living this reality because we remember that 50 years ago, Dr. King said that there was something in the center of the American spirit, a malady, that was making the U.S. society a threat to the entire world. He also said 50 years ago that the U.S. was the greatest purveyor of violence on this planet. 50 years later, that still remains the reality. What that says, my friends, is that the struggle is constant. It ebbs and it flows. But it means that there has to be a core of us that always believe in and are committed to struggling for real power to the people. That when we talk about power to the people, we talk about building democracy. We're talking about what it takes for us to be able to realize that power. And for us, that means the fundamental transformation of the society. It means that we have to put back on the agenda, back in the center of our program, the objective. And that objective is basically for revolutionary change. We're not going to be able to get rid of the scourge of war until we understand that. We're not going to be able to live up to our responsibility to the people of the world until we understand that this rapacious, greedy, backward, capitalist class has to be disempowered. That until we take away their ability to impose their will on the masses of people in this country around the world, we're never going to be able to eliminate the scourge of war, because it is through war and violence and repression that they're able to maintain their dominance. So we are here this weekend, and we're going to have a lot of information that we've been exposed to. We're going to talk about the number of bases and talk about the military budget. We're going to talk about why it's important for us to organize ourselves and what might we do after this weekend. But my message this evening is for us to think about our responsibility to the world, to understand that this challenge of building an anti-war movement is not an add-on to what we already are doing. And that's something that we just sort of incorporate lightly. My position and the position of the Black Alliance for Peace is that this anti-war movement, this movement against repression, this movement to address and confront directly imperialism is a fundamental responsibility we have to the world, because it is this state operating in our name that's imposing untold misery on millions of people around this world. You know, they came up with a concept the concept of humanitarian intervention and the responsibility to protect. The cover that they use in order to intervene and to undermine societies. But the question that has to be raised is, who protects the people from them? And the answer, my friends, is basically us. Alfred talked about the fact that we have certain special responsibilities, and we do. We are at the center of empire. That's why this coalition is so fundamentally important. The very fact that we can talk about the fact that the U.S. has bases around the world in 172 nations, that very fact itself demonstrates that this is, in fact, an empire. And that understanding has to be communicated to the American people. That being part of an empire, being part of a system in which 1% of the population is able to impose its interests on all of the rest of us in this country and around the world, it means that we have a special responsibility, that we are strategically located to undermine that power when we understand our responsibility. So we have to remind ourselves and to remind all of the people we work with of that special responsibility. We have to tell people in this country that you can't pretend that you believe in the sanctity of life, that you believe in human rights, that you believe that that black lives matter, while at the same time you don't speak out when the lives of Palestinians are being threatened and taken. When you have a humanitarian disaster in Yemen, where this state engages in a veritable rampage across Western Asia, what we call the Middle East, where ancient cities are destroyed, millions of people murdered, and millions of people displaced. All lives, in fact, do matter. And our responsibility is to make sure that that principle is translated into policy, into political stances. And the only way that we're able to do that is when we name the enemy and are committed to struggling against that enemy. So we have to say very clearly who the enemy is. If us in the Black Alliance for Peace, we're clear. We understand that there is a permanent war agenda, because that is the only way in which this minority can maintain its dominance. So we understand that in order for us to advance the interests of the Black community and the oppressed community, it's for us to recognize that we are fundamentally connected to all the people of the world, to all of the oppressed people of the world. We recognize that what we have when we have war and conflict is, in fact, a class battle. We recognize that we have to name the terms of this battle and the enemy. And that enemy is this rapacious, white supremacist, colonial, capitalist patriarchy. We name that enemy because we have to be very clear. And we have to be very clear in our engagements with the people. We have to name that enemy because we don't have the luxury not to do that. We don't have the luxury because the people who are in the crosshairs of U.S. imperialism don't have the luxury. So we say that we have to confront ourselves, that the era of the politics of respectability, of pragmatism, of glossing over these contradictions is over. Because the enemy itself, they understand that the only way that they're going to be able to maintain their dominance is through more force and more violence and more repression. Their answer to the legitimation crisis that they face is force, violence, and repression. So all of the nice ways in which the relations of power was camouflaged using the tools of ideology, now because of this legitimation crisis, it boils down now to the naked use of power. So we have to be clear. We have to be clear about that. That as we go forward, that this crisis that they face in terms of legitimacy, which is connected to the crisis they face in terms of the dysfunctionality of this system, that's only going to get worse. Therefore, we have to be clear, and the people have to be clear what it is we're up against, and we have to be clear about what it is we need to fight for. So we say very clearly that we are opposed to this enemy that is the enemy of humankind. And we also clear that the only way that we're going to be able to advance our collective interests is when we recognize that war is an instrument of class rule, and that we have to, in fact, overthrow this enemy and build a new society on a new basis. And we have to be very clear about that and say very openly that the only way we can do that is when we eliminate capitalism and commit ourselves to a new kind of economic, political, and social system organized on the basis of the needs of the people. And that system has to be, and it is called socialism. So, my friends, we have a task before us this weekend. We have to struggle among ourselves to build a baseline for unity, because we know that all of us may not be there in terms of being prepared to take a clear class line. We may not have full agreement on what it means for national oppression and national liberation. We may not be in agreement in terms of the character of this state. But we can agree that anytime you have this state involved in direct intervention, anytime you have this state that is involved in attacking another state and another people and another nation, that is a crime that all of us can be united in opposing. That commitment to peace can be the baseline. And what that means is that no matter what may be happening internally to a particular country, in a particular state, we have to have a commitment to the principle that that is their business. We may have opinions about what is happening in that state. We can take positions on that individually and through our organizations, but we should be committed to the principle that no matter what may be happening, no matter what are the contradictions in that nation state, anytime that there is intervention by outside forces and the U.S. particularly, we should be opposed to that. That's the baseline that we should have. So, my friends, we have a lot of work to do. We have to use this campaign as an entry point to talk about empire, to talk about our responsibility, to impress upon the people the fact that the most effective expression of internationalism is to, in fact, be anti-war. That we live on this planet collectively, and that we cannot be concerned about social justice in the U.S. and be silent about the sufferings of our fellow human beings around the world. We must understand that in this anti-war movement that we build, that movement isn't just focused externally. That the opposition to war and to violence and repression has to be connected to our understanding of the repressive character, the war and the violence that's carried out right here within our borders. That right here within the borders of this territory we call the United States of America, in these black and brown colonized spaces, we face an eternal enemy that's waging a war internally. This domestic military that we call the police, their job is to control and to contain us. And so our responsibility is to make those connections, to see the common interests, to recognize again that we cannot be focused just on the U.S. or just on outside of the country. That we have to have an awareness, a consciousness in which all of these connections are made in terms of the common enemy and our common interests. And to connect up these struggles, that's the basis of real solidarity. That's what we strive for this weekend. That's what we must do and create with this coalition and with this campaign. Our responsibility is, in fact, to do that, to find a way in which we can build unity, to understand that if we don't do that, we have failed ourselves and we have failed the world. Thank you.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has spent the last 36 years behind bars for the death of a Philadelphia policeman. Abu-Jamal's supporters see the possibility of overturning his conviction. Ronald Castile, a former prosecutor in Mumia's case, went on to become a judge and then wound up ruling against Mumia's appeal. Castile was also a great friend of the Fraternal Order of Police. Mumia's lawyers say Castile should have recused himself from the case. A state court judge has repeatedly ordered the district attorney's office to turn over all of its records in Mumia's case. Mumia's supporters were encouraged when a progressive lawyer named Larry Krasner was elected as the new district attorney for Philadelphia. However, Krasner appointed former prosecutor Ronald Castile to his transition team. "That's not a good sign," said Gwen Dubrow of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
The DA's proposing that Ronald Castile only played a perfunctory role in the prosecution of Mumia, and that is simply not the case. Not the case at all. Ronald Castile played a significant role in attaining a conviction against Mumia, who is innocent, by the way. They used perjured testimony, false ballistics, false confessions to attain a conviction against Mumia. In fact, the original judge who heard Mumia's case said that he was going to help them fry the nigger. That's what a judge said. And then when we learned of that, we immediately filed a motion for a hearing. And Pamela Dendy unbelievably said that that didn't have anything to do with the case, with the final outcome of the case, which is ridiculous.
Can you talk a little bit more about who is Ronald Castile and how does he fit within this atmosphere that can allow for a sitting judge to make a statement like the one that you've just recounted for us?
Ronald was a senior district attorney when Mumia's case was litigated, and he also became the head district attorney when Mumia's case was on appeal. So much so that, like I said, Judge Tucker wants to find out more of what Ronald Castile's role was in Mumia's case, because there were files that were discovered in reference to Ronald Castile questioning his DA of where the appeals case was in reference to Mumia filing an appeals with the U.S. Supreme Court. So we know Ronald Castile played a significant role in Mumia's case because he was there. Like I said, he was the senior district attorney, then he rose to head district attorney, and then he became a Pennsylvania Supreme Court justice when Mumia's case was litigated in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Ronald Castile was a judge then. And he also did not exclude himself from hearing and then ruling on Mumia's case when it was up for appeal in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is a blatant violation of Mumia's constitutional rights. So says the U.S. Supreme Court in Williams versus Pennsylvania as late as June 2016. So the district attorney is playing a dangerous game of saying that Ronald Castile had no real impact or role in Mumia's case, when that is simply a blatant lie. It's just continued cover up so they can keep Mumia in prison wrongfully. And Mumia is, like I said, the least likely to have killed anyone. And they know it. The only reason why Mumia is where he's at is because of his political activism when he was a Black Panther at 14. The FBI had a file on Mumia. They even said, I read it myself, they even said that Mumia was clean. He basically was a good kid and posed no threat. He was basically just an active kid working on behalf of his people. Yet, and still, the FBI, like I said, followed him and also wrote in his file on the back of a picture, dead, the word dead on the back of it. In spite of their own investigation, that Mumia wasn't a criminal.
Ronald Castile has a rather intimate relationship with the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police. Is that right?
That is correct. He was named Man of the Year when he was running for a seat on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and won. He was also funded by the Fraternal Order of Police. Ronald Castile also brags about sending 45 people to death row. This is not someone who is, in my estimation, would be normal. I mean, who brags about sending people to death row? And then later on, the man actually participates in hearing their appeals and, not surprisingly, rules against them. That's not a surprise. Now we have a precedent case in Williams versus Pennsylvania that says that that is unconstitutional. All we need now is for the DA to be forthcoming with the files, with all of the files in Mumia's case that will clearly show what Ronald Castile's role was in Mumia's case. I mean, the DA's office even produced a tape in which they teach assistant DAs how to keep people of color, black people, and other minorities off of juries. So you tell me if that's not loading the deck in favor of them and against justice. They're only interested in conviction. They're not really interested in getting the right person who actually killed someone. That's the only thing they're interested in, is winning convictions and be damned the truth of what actually really happened in Mumia's case and a whole lot of other cases. Ronald Christie has a checkered history. He's basically a hack judge who never should have sat as a jurist and probably should have never become a DA, because he's clearly biased. He's clearly a racist and only cares about winning, no matter what the cost to human life.
That was Gwen Dubrow of the campaign to bring Mumia home. The city of New Orleans is celebrating its 300th birthday this week. A three-day conference on the Black experience in New Orleans is scheduled to begin on January 18th under the direction of Dr. Clyde Robertson, Director of African and African American Studies at Southern University, New Orleans. The events surrounding Hurricane Katrina in 2005 are a low mark in the Black historical journey. 100,000 black people were forced into exile after the storm, and Dr. Robertson remembers that much of the white power structure saw the mass removal of blacks from the city as a good thing, a great opportunity.
Well, it served as an opportunity, actually. I mean, look at what has been done. They've taken over the school system, and New Orleans does not have what I would call an industrial base. It does not have Fortune 500 companies. So the avenue to the middle class in the city of New Orleans was through the school system. Yet 70 plus thousand people employed by way of the school system, the New Orleans public school system. It was the largest employer of black people. It was the school system, the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, and the federal government. And then Tulane University. They took the school system from the people and created charters instead. What did the charters do? The first thing the charters did, the first thing, even before establishing school sites, they fired all of the teachers and administrators, my wife and I being two of them. 7,500 people. It never reached the news status. The ACLU never dealt with our cases. That's why I have no love for the ACLU. That made it easy for them to replace us with Teach for Americans. And right now, in the city of New Orleans, if not 50%, the majority of the teachers in the city are young whites. And what they wanted was not only control of education and control of educating black children and minority, in quotes, minority children, but they also wanted that huge budget that the New Orleans public school system had, which was like $500 million right prior to Hurricane Katrina. And the control of that money rested in the hands of a black superintendent, black administration, majority black principals, and the like. And every school system around New Orleans was salvaged, with the exception of New Orleans.
And the firing of 7,500 mostly black teachers, that resulted in the uprooting of much of the city's black middle class, in addition to the washing away of broad swaths of the population.
Of the population and of the community, and, my brother Ford, of the politicized community. These were the people who were voting regularly. These were the people who were deciding to run for political office. These were the people whose children were being trained for leadership. These were the people and their communities. And so what happened as a result was that many school systems were enriched, not by our children during those days immediately following Katrina, months and years immediately following Katrina, but by our professionals who were not allowed to return back to the city, who were not given jobs in the school system, when they returned. And many of them returned, rebuilt their homes, only to leave again because of lack of opportunities. So, yes, it was a golden opportunity. Another thing they did was to recapture many communities that had become African American. The Bywater, for example, portions of the Ninth Ward, for example, portions of Mid-City, for example, which had over the years become African-American, strong African-American enclaves. After the storm, they took opportunities to move people in. So, yes, they did take this opportunity to redevelop the city of New Orleans. Now, it is still majority black. That's simply because black New Orleanians love this town so much, we returned to water-soaked, water-logged communities. And by ourselves, almost, rebuilt them. But without the resources to reinforce the communities with groceries, with malls, and with industry. So what we want to do is to highlight our presence in the city. We want to highlight our impact as a people in the city. And we want to highlight the impact that this city has had on us.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.